I believe we're joined now by Peter McFarlane. Are you there, Peter?
Yes, I am.
Thanks very much for joining us. What a great timing, because the Liberal Party is having a debate over who should be leading their party. And what I should say, by the way, that Peter McFarlane is the author of Family Ties, How a Ukrainian Nazi and a Living Witness Link Canada to Ukraine Today. And he has written a review of a book by Catherine Salikis. The title of the book is From Peace Valley to Parliament. And Peter's review is titled When Ambition Runs Out of Ammunition. Great title. Peter, you know, the Salikis book, I mean, in the U.S. you would say this is a campaign biography. Have you figured out how the timing was? She steps out of the cabinet and barely gets through the door, and the book is there. So, what's about the background of this book?
Yeah, the book was planned for quite a long time. I guess it was probably in the works for 2 or 3 years. But I think Freeland always knew that she was going to run to replace Trudeau whenever he left. And you know, she's the title of the article, "Ambition Without Ammunition," is actually a phrase that Freeland liked to use about other people who she didn't consider her equals. She would say, "Well, they have ambition without ammunition," and her friends then would call Freeland somebody with ambition with ammunition. And so the idea that she was going to gun for the top job, I think it was in the works from the very beginning. So the book is described as unauthorized by the author, unauthorized biography, but in fact, I mean, it couldn't be any closer to being authorized. Freeland didn't speak to her, but Freeland told her friends and her family members to speak to Salikis for the book. And so it is a very glowing portrait in most ways.
There's something canny
later, something
there. Something canny there. It's like establishing a little distance while still controlling the narrative, right?
Exactly. And for Freeland, I think it was absolutely necessary, because the problem she has is, again, the elephant in the room is her Nazi collaborating grandfather, who she has to this day refused to admit and to condemn. And so any book written by Freeland, she would have to explain that. And by this having this basically liberal back up a bit, Salikis' most recent job was the editor of a liberal sort of house organ called Open Canada. And so she's got the right politics for the job. Freeland had her family members and friends speak to her. So it's an arm's distance autobiography in a sense.
Mm-hmm. By the way, your review is in The Breach, is it not?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
People find please go to that site. And by the way, please get Peter's book. It's published by Lorimer, and buy five and give them to your friends. She seems to be finally reached a point where she's been sort of like a meteor, always on the rise. But she seems to be hit, mixing all my metaphors. She appears to be in choppy waters at the moment. Things are not quite the way they were when they were always. She was the go-to person as the authority, right?
That's right. Well, in the book, you actually see that this is a kind of a pattern with Freeland, she rises quickly, but she reaches a blockage. And one of the things that comes through is because Salikis interviews people who worked with Freeland, and you see people like Jan Wong, who worked with her at the Globe and Mail, describes her as a completely untrustworthy person. You can't trust her. She was only interested in managing determined to manage upwards. She always made sure she was on good terms with the bosses, and she treated the people below her very poorly. So, and that happens again and again in her career as a journalist too. And so, it's kind of she's kind of recapitulated that in politics, where she has a great rise, and she gets to the very near the top, but in the end, she kind of fizzles, and this is what happened, I think, with her career. And I think the most notable thing about that is that when she declared her candidacy, we were told in the press that she was so popular that virtually all the cabinet ministers, the people who would know her best, went with Carney. They abandoned her right away. And so it kind of fits the pattern of her life.
Hmm. Yeah, what you're describing there, I recall reading currently she's trying to play what they call the populist card, and almost now we're getting pushback from major outlets like CBC, who said, how do you call yourself a populist and an outsider when you've been in the job? But I recall also that even when she joined, I read the Linda Diebel article, which was hagiographic, and she played hard to get. She wasn't a populist. She said, I don't know if I want to do this. You know, that doesn't sound like a populist.
No, that's it. She measures things very carefully, I think. And I'm not too sure that playing hard to get was another strategy. She's very good at that type of strategic. Mm-hmm. Her father, apparently, this is in Talika's book, spoke to Katie Telford and said that they should really ask Freeland to run, that she really would do a great job. So that's kind of an odd intervention mentioned in the book. And yes, it seems to me natural that it came from Freeland, that Freeland used her father to put the bug in the ear of the Liberals.
Yeah. I was surprised over the weekend that the Globe had an article about saying how similar she was with Carney. But, you know, Carney, to me, reading her life, and particularly thanks to your book, Family Ties, her story is not like Carney's story. As a matter of fact, it's the title From Peace Valley to Parliament. It ought to say via Kiev, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, that was the biggest issue. And interestingly, she was the first elected in 2013 in the fall in a by-election in Toronto Centre riding. And it was at that exact moment that kind of things blew up in Kiev, that the Maidan revolution was taking place. And it ended, I guess, in February 2014. But it was in the fall of 2013, there were massive demonstrations in the Maidan Square in downtown Kiev. And she kind of played that as an important card in her rise, that she was the leading voice in the Liberal Party for an activist foreign policy that would go out there and save Ukraine.
Yes, I mean, she was in Nathan Phillips Square photograph. I think it's in your book or not. It's certainly in your postings. By the way, Peter McFarlane has an excellent Twitter account. People should go there. But the picture's been seen widely of her holding the Bandera flag. It's the Nazi collaborators in World War II. And your book illustrates that the family is all considered themselves Bandera supporters. And naturally, that made her persona non grata with the Russians. I don't understand why the Liberals went forward making her foreign minister, or why they would even think about her becoming prime minister when she has such an adversarial position on a sovereign country.
Absolutely, and that's the tie-in was there. You mentioned her holding the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists banner in Phillips Square. And the family, as you also mentioned, was closely allied with the sort of extreme nationalists in Ukraine since the 1930s at least. And her grandfather, he mentioned in the book, he was editor of the Kakivsky Visti, that was a pro-Nazi newspaper published out of Krakow. That he was editor for about 4 or 5 years, and it was the most anti-Semitic rag you could imagine. It certainly contributed to the Holocaust in Ukraine. And it is that connection, that family connection, that she cannot really speak about, and she has to avoid speaking about. But it's certainly a motivation. She was a friend in Canada with the leading Bandera people, and behind the scenes sort of thing. So that's where she comes from politically. It also, again, it's difficult for her to address that because, you know, Canadians don't take kindly to support for, you know, pro-Nazi organizations, as we found out during the Hunka affair in September, I think it's 2023. I think there was like thousands of letters that came in condemning the government for applauding the Ukrainian SS man. So she knows that the Canadians are very wary of that connection to her, in her family, and so she has to downplay it, and that's what she does whenever she can escape speaking about it. She certainly does.
Yeah, you know, it's always a question. People, one of the reasons people want to see debates and want to look at them and make their own judgment, you know, of what, and very often voters are just looking to see if whether they like this person, whether they consider them credible and honest, and that's supposed to be part of the sorting out of a debate. But it's kind of, here's my question. We seem to have a media elite that can't handle the truth. I mean, shouldn't a question be tonight, you know, no offense to you, Krista, but you know that you've been asked about your grandfather, but you've never answered that. Do you want to clear that up? But why are they afraid of the truth, or okay, they can't handle it? They won't put that kind of question?
Yeah, I don't know the motivations of some of them are they're sort of on the same ideological wave as her. The world is kind of a black and white, and you have the evil Putin and his orcs, and they're on the side of Gandalf and the light, and so you don't question anybody who is standing up against the orcs. You know, but, I mean, it's kind of that simple fantasy world. I think that much of the Western politics takes place, and then we see that in Europe as well. That right now they're determined to keep that war going, even though the war, in fact, it's destroying Ukraine, and they rally against any idea that there can be a peace as a surrender. But the fact is, every week the war goes on, Ukraine loses more people, loses more territory. But so it's the same idea that they won't question Freeland on the sort of the Nazi past of her family and why she won't condemn it. Mm-hmm. And they also won't face reality and what's happening actually on the ground in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And on that point of what her point of view is and how she's being represented in this biography by Catherine Salikis, the word they use, because the point you made in the family ties so overwhelmingly was that he was a collaborator with the Nazis, and he agreed with them. It wasn't that he had some, he just happened to be there. And the word they use to cover this is in the biography, as you talk about in your review, is he's a nationalist. I want to tie that to something I read in your book or in the review, I forget which, where the discussing the anti-Semitism of his writing in Krakvisti Visti, he said it said of him that he did that, but also there was a layer of nationalism which would have appealed to him, is the way the author puts it, would have appealed to him. I want to ask you and her. Well, did the anti-Semitism appeal to him?
Yeah, I found that was the oddest paragraph in the book. She goes on. She speaks about that the newspaper Krakvisti Visti that he edited for 4 years. That Michael Chomiak edited for 4 years, and she says it followed the ideology of the, you know, Nazi occupation government, that it was dependent for support. And its pages were filled with Nazi propaganda attacking Jews, Poles, and Soviets. But it also contained a layer of Ukrainian nationalism, which would have appealed to Michael, which is ridiculous because he was the editor.
That sounds like a form of apologetics. It's so cute the way that sentence is written.
Nazi propaganda attacking Jews, Poles, and Soviets. he also put in the paper. He approved everything that went in the paper every day. So this way that you could just parse out that it contained some nationalism that would appeal to him. He was the editor of the whole paper, which was a Nazi-supported and a Nazi propaganda newspaper with some of the most vilest anti-Semitic writing that you would ever find.
Well, your book points out, I don't know if she notices it, but you say she's aware of it, the author, Catherine Siliki. He commissioned articles. By the way, when we say commission, I assume he paid for those articles by scholars. And these were anti-Semitic scholars. These guys considered themselves political scientists. And if he commissioned it, it sounds a little like it's not just nationalism.
Exactly. The information that comes from a lot of that information about the newspaper comes from a PhD thesis by Ernest Guidel, who was his thesis advisor was Jean-Paul Hemke, which is actually a Freeland's uncle. But and in the paper, in his PhD thesis, Guidel plots out the way that Tomiak commissioned each of these anti-Semitic articles. He has letters that he wrote asking for these anti-Semitic articles, and he shows other letters where Tomiak said he agreed with them, the content of the letters. He said that, in fact, they were kind of balanced articles about the Jews in Ukraine, and they were the most rank anti-Semitic screeds that you would ever see. And so he was very much part of that ideology. There's no question.
Yeah. There's another aspect of that I really think it's important, particularly it is in your book, but it's always been argued, part of the argument is, well, okay, he's a collaborator, he has to do what they tell him. Okay, but the war was over. As my understanding is that post-World War II, he continued to engage in correspondence with his old chums.
Right.
And in that correspondence, he was praising people who were writing anti-Semitic materials. We're talking post-World War II, right?
That's right. That comes from Ernest Guidel's thesis as well. And the interesting thing is that Salaka spoke to, I presumably read Guidel's writing, because she quotes him in the book, but she doesn't. She quotes him on this kind of unrelated matter that had nothing to do with the heart of his research, which was showing that Michael Chomiak was a Nazi collaborator of the First Order. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes back again and again, is that, of course, Christopher Freeland is not responsible for what her grandfather did, not at all. But what is the problem is that she won't either admit it or she won't condemn it. And that's really that she won't condemn it. I mean, there's lots of people who are grandsons and granddaughters of Nazis in Europe, et cetera. But there's some expectation that they won't praise them and consider them guides of how to run their life like she has done in the past, that they will at least make some kind of statement that they don't agree with their politics. Freeland refuses all that. She continues to refuse and suggest that all those writings about her grandfather were kind of some kind of Russian misinformation campaign. And in fact, most of the information, virtually a lot of the information, comes from the family archives in Edmonton. It's all there.
Yeah, it's like we've spoken before about this, and I spoke with Ann Charney. The tongue turns always to the aching tooth. That is, why can't she confront it? You know, political advisors, when something bad happens, they always tell the guy, get in front of a microphone and say you're against that, and you apologize, and get it out of the way. But this, it's in her hands, and she's allowing it to fester. I don't know if she'll be able to run to the end of her days without ever answering the question.
And that's right. I think the difficulty is for her is that she's a part of a movement where the Banderites and the organization of Ukrainian nationalists have been resurrected basically today in Ukraine. And I mean, if you go to Lviv, you can hardly walk 15 minutes in the city without hitting a Nazi collaborator or Holocaust perpetrator monument plaque or street name. I mean, they're all there. They've resurrected that politics. So it's a little more difficult for her to condemn Michael Chomiak for following the politics of this revival in Western Ukraine. It's, again, not all of Ukraine, but
I'm really Western glad Ukraine, you said Western Ukraine, because we've spoken before, but this is so important. When they formed the SS group, the Galician SS, that was the understanding even of their Nazi masters, is that you guys are Galicians. And I know you've pointed out that when the elections have taken place in Ukraine, the voting in the region, we can say Western, but also many people call Galicia because it used to be under the Austrians, etc. This is a minority group, actually, within the larger Ukraine.
Absolutely, yes. And the party was the Svoboda Party. It was before, I guess, 2014. It was the super right-wing party that I think it was called the Socialist Nationalist Party before it changed.
That's convenient.
Svoboda. It gives you an idea. Their flag was kind of swastika-like at the time. They rose to the great influence in Western Ukraine during the 2000s. They played a massive role in the Maidan. They were the ones, mainly they and their supporters, were the ones that were armed on the square. But at the same time, in eastern Ukraine, they had like zero support. It was a Galician historical movement that was resurrecting old Galician heroes who were SS men and part of the sort of the brutal militias of the OUN and the later one was called UPA, the organization of insurgent Ukrainians. Yeah.
We're speaking to Peter McFarlane. His article is in The Breach, and it's When Ambition Runs Out of Ammunition. Of course, he's also the author of Family Ties, Lorimer. You know, you've raised a larger question for how Canada has got to where it is. And I wish it was I hope it would be part of the debate tonight. I would doubt it. But you point out that we had, as foreign minister, when Trudeau was first elected and everybody was in love with him for about 20 minutes, but he had a foreign minister, Dion, and they were going to project renewing relations with Russia or improving them, and same with China. And Chrystia's wing of the cabinet apparently became very noisy, and they threw Dion out. But the policy they were following was a very rational policy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was the policy was the sort of the traditional Canadian foreign policy that saw itself as an honest broker in world affairs. That would be the policy that was before the time of Harper, who preceded them. As you mentioned, Stéphane Dion was named as foreign minister. His statement at the time was that Canadians must engage with leaders with whom they do not agree. And it's often a mistake to sever all ties with a regime we don't like. And so they saw the Canadian role again as a honest broker and a peacemaker, constructive, a fair-minded and a constructive peacemaker. That's what Trudeau had said Canada's foreign policy would be when they returned to power. But at the same time, and this is from Zelika's book, she tells us that Freeland was sort of fiercely lobbying for a more aggressive foreign policy, and especially with Ukraine, and that we had to, you know, throw Russia out of all the international organizations, and we had to isolate Russia, and we had to bring in nuclear sanctions against Russia to destroy their economy and then bring down Putin. This was the goal that she was speaking of, the goal that was shared by, I think, the Americans at the same time. And finally, she won out, and she was appointed Minister of Foreign Affairs, Global Affairs, I guess it is now. And at the same time, she was she made the Ukraine sort of the central issue for Canada, and that she would pursue that and sort of transform Canada's foreign policy along those lines. And she did it in Ukraine, but also her foreign policy disasters were kind of one after another. In Venezuela, she created the Lima Group that was to isolate and bring down the government in Venezuela. It was a disaster. Her policy against China, with the arrest of the executive held for, I think, 2 years in Canada on charges that I guess had been brought in the United States. And so she, the foreign policy of Canada was kind of destroyed under her with China, with Russia, and again, it was also with India, but that was another story. So it was a dismal failure, her foreign policy. And people inside the government were very clear that Tsalik is interviewed saying that Trudeau's foreign policy was Chrystia Freeland's foreign policy, that she was the one guiding it.
She was very much in sync with the New World Order under the Bush gang, leading to the other gangs, and very comfortable because they could say that Juan Guaido was the president of Venezuela and actually bring him to Canada. And now nobody can even remember who he was. Yeah. Really outlandish. But her world seems to be coming apart, actually. The New World Order business, this is where the choppy waters comes in, right?
That's right. Well, for one reason, the Liberal Party was quite aware that it was true that many of her policies and positions were adopted by Trudeau. And so when the leadership election was called, the campaign was called, I think Trudeau's popularity was at 16% in the polls. So the Liberals, I think, saw very clearly that her way was the absolute wrong way, that it, it brought the party into, you know, distant third-party status again. And so that was where the part of the choppy waters for her. And we see the choppy waters, too, was she was a big fan of Davos and the big ideas of
She's sort of a club member, right? I mean, she just shows up like a member of the fraternity or whatever it is.
Absolutely. And she was a believer in the Fukuyama's end of history type of theory that was very popular in the West. That with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the West had won, and their ideology would slowly take over the world. And anybody who fought against it was some kind of an awful reactionary, and we would censor them in some way. Or attack them directly, as we did in places like Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq, and because we had the kind of the right as the economic, military, and moral leaders of the world with the in this end of history world, and I think that's what's coming to the end in Europe right now. As well.
History seems to be coming toward us with great speed. And history will be on time, whether we know it or not.
That's right. And in the meantime, in the last several years, there was a Brown study that said that our wars in the global south had cost about 1 million dead, 3.5 million deaths indirectly, and tens of millions of refugees. And it cost the United States more than $8 trillion. That's in the last 20 years or so. And so I think that's what's coming to an end. And I think that's part of the reason why we unfortunately have Trump. Because it's ruined the West.
Yeah. Well, Peter McFarland, I sure hope people follow you on Twitter. You've been keeping us, I read that regularly. It keeps people up to date. People should go to that site. And the author of Family Ties, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Phil. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. And I think we're there practically. I want to say again, we are in solidarity with Eve Engler, and we hope he's out of jail by now. But it's great to have hero journalists. It's been a while since we've had this kind of occurrence, and I know people will rally behind him. And I want to thank Pedro, and actually I should make sure I say McKembe. I want to thank you all. This is Taylor Report, and a great show coming up. We'll see you.